failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. I'm glad you could be with us. Today we've got a couple of reports coming out of Canada dealing with the symbiotic relationship between the U.S. and Canada. One from a Canadian, Mr. Philippe Lucas, head of the Vancouver Island Compassion Society, and Mr. Norm Stamper, former police chief of Seattle, Washington. First up, Philippe Lucas. Well, once again, I'm proud to have with us here on the Drug Truth Network, Mr. Philippe Lucas. Philippe, you're a busy man. Tell the folks a bit about the work you do up there in Canada.
Sure. I'm a founder and director of the Vancouver Island Compassion Society, which is a medicinal cannabis nonprofit research and supply organization. And I'm also one of the founders of Canadians for Safe Access, which is basically the baby sister organization to Americans for Safe Access. And on top of that, I'm pretty involved in general drug policy reform here in Canada, but also drug policy research, which basically, if I could state one goal that I have, it's to move us towards rational drug policies that are based on common sense, compassion, and on evidence-based research.
Now, Philippe, you are also tuned in, I would say, to what's going on up there in Canada, and that's why we like to call on you. I understand that recently there was a Voices of Substance conference held up in Victoria. Tell us about that, if you would.
Sure. A few months ago, I think it was in November, about 10 of us gathered, 10 interested citizens who wanted to look at alternative approaches to prohibition and alternative approaches basically to drug policy here within Canada, but also really focusing on our local municipality. And so with that idea, we started a group that ended up being called Voices of Substance. And on just last week, we had our first event, our first conference. It was called The Cost of Doing Nothing, Looking Beyond Our Current Approaches to Substance Use. And it basically made a socioeconomic argument for moving towards harm reduction practices like safe consumption sites, treatment on demand, and increased services for detox as well.
And this is what I like about Canada. There is at least a willingness, an openness. People talk about change. People make change. They dare to bring forward ideas that in the U.S. are squelched and squashed and put aside. Your thoughts, sir, what is it about Canada that's different? What makes it possible up there?
Well, I think the only thing that's really different between Canada and U.S. prohibition right now is that we're able to have a dialogue that, it seems to me, at a much higher level. We're able to involve higher-level politicians in this debate, in this dialogue. For example, at the Voices of Substance conference, our opening address was given by the mayor of the city of Victoria, which is the capital of British Columbia. We also had, as part of the Voices of Substance planning group, a couple of local police officers. In fact, the local police force gave us some funding towards putting on this conference. And so we're seeing a wider level of cooperation and a willingness to look at alternatives to our current approaches to drug prohibition, because the one thing that this conference was really filled out, it was standing room only. We'd originally anticipated 140 participants, and we ended up with 180 and really pushed the place to the rafters. But the one thing that we could all agree from all walks of life, all the people who showed up at this conference, is that our current approaches aren't working. The status quo is not helping anyone right now. It's not helping the drug users. It's not helping those who are affected by drug-related crime. And it really demeans all of us, our current approaches.
Well, this follows rather closely on the heels of the harm reduction conference of, about 5-6 weeks ago. A couple of 3 weeks back, there was the anti-DEA conference up in Montreal. The U.S. is beginning to gain traction.
Well, I partially agree with you. I think that there's regions in the U.S. where there's no way that this dialogue could take place. On the other hand, I think there's regions of Canada less receptive to it. Certainly our federal government right now isn't receptive to any argument in favor of reducing penalties around substance use or modernizing our drug policy. I would suggest that this Voices of Substance conference and is really modeled after conferences, a few of which have taken place in the U.S., the King County Bar Association Conference in Seattle, the Syracuse Drug Policy Audit, and even the Hartford Conference that our friend Cliff Thornton helped organize through Efficacy. These are all, I think, a reaction to working gauge federal governments that are not giving voice to alternatives to prohibition right now. And so community-based organizing, municipal organizing, in order to change our approaches to drug policy, seems to be a response to that, I think. I think it's truly grassroots in that it's dealing with the problem in a made-in, fill-in-blank approach. In other words, here it's made in Victoria. In Syracuse, it's a made-in-Syracuse solution to the drug war. In Hartford, it was a made-in-Hartford solution. All of them come to the same conclusion once again, which is that our current approaches are failing us miserably, and they're only adding to the misery and the horrors associated with problematic substance use and with the war on drugs.
You know, I saw a story coming out that there are some in Great Britain now who want to change their laws. They had moved to a softly approach, I think it's called. And there are others now saying that any caught with more than 5 grams, which can be anywhere from 5 to 10 joints, I suppose, but more than 5 grams would be considered dealers and subject to prison sentences of up to 14 years. Where do these people come from? I mean,
I hate to answer that, but unfortunately, they may have come from Canada. If you recall the Liberals' decriminalization bill from a few years back, in Canada, we proposed decriminalizing up to 5 grams of cannabis. Less than 5 grams would have been a finable offense, and then we doubled the penalties associated with even minor production of cannabis and boosted the maximum penalty to 14 years in prison. And so it was funny when I read about the proposed changes to the British prohibition laws and drug laws, I was really reminded of an experiment that we almost went into here in Canada, for better or for worse.
Limiting the amount to 5 grams makes sure that the user is forced to visit the black market on a consistent, regular basis, keeping the price high, and in effect, providing price supports for the black market, is it not?
Oh, yeah, absolutely it is. And even more so, Dean, I'd suggest that amount really puts medical users at risk. We have members of the Vancouver Island Compassion Society who are really bedbound, and they might only get to the Compassion Society once a month. And I know that the same is true in the U.S. and in the U.K. with medical users. And so their supply might be an ounce a month, it might be 2 ounces a month, it might be 3 ounces a month. And so those medical users are going to be ensnared by any law that doesn't recognize amounts above 5 grams, certainly. So I have real worries right now about the laws in Canada, the U.S., and in England, and the way that they're affecting and continue to impinge upon the medical use of cannabis.
Okay, you mentioned the Vancouver Island Compassion Society, and you are aligned in some ways with the Canadian government to provide a better product, to grow and distribute legitimate medical marijuana. Please describe the situation in Canada for medical marijuana.
The Vancouver Island Compassion Society and all of Canada's compassion clubs, and there are about 10 well-established clubs here in Canada, that compared to the over 200 currently in operation in California alone, are not licensed, they're not legal, and they operate with the continued support of our local community and our local municipality. There's nothing to theoretically stop the federal government from, or the federal police officers, the RCMP, from coming in and shutting in our operations, except for the incredibly good work that we do. As a result of that, in Canada, we've taken a bit of a different approach than the U.S. About half of our compassion societies are actually registered nonprofit societies, and in other words, they're not run for profit. They're not owned by the operators. The Vancouver Island Compassion Society is a nonprofit that holds an annual general meeting every year, and that's really governed by a board of directors. And so that's a little bit of what makes it different. I would like to mention, however, though, in response to the accusations in both Canada and the U.S., the compassion clubs don't follow any rules or regulations and don't do any self-policing. We've just finished, myself and Riel Kapler, the director of the Vancouver club, which is called the British Columbia Compassion Club Society, we finished a document called Guidelines for the Community-Based Distribution of Medical Cannabis in Canada. It's a set of rules and regulations that set a base standard for the operation of a medical cannabis dispensary. We've been working on this for over a year, and we hope that this is going to help alleviate some of the fears around the community-based distribution of cannabis, or some of the concerns, mostly at the federal level, and that it's going to set a good standard for people who might want to move into medical cannabis distribution. And I think it's going to be an incredibly useful document in the U.S. as well, where the biggest accusation that's being tossed, particularly against the California clubs, is that they're completely unregulated and that they have no standards of operation. So as soon as we're done the final draft of this, which should be by the end of next week, we're going to release it extensively, and I'd love to see a U.S. version of this document come about in the next few months.
Perhaps there's a website where that will be posted once it's done, and where else, what other involvements do you have that you would like to send others to visit on the web?
Two good questions. That document's going to be available at the Vancouver Island Compassion Society website, which is www.thevics.com. That's thevics.com. And it should be posted within the next 10 days, I would suggest. I've also been working and organizing another major project around medical marijuana here in Canada, and it's called the Virtual Medical Marijuana March on Ottawa. What we're trying to do is tap into that 90% of the Canadian public that support the use and distribution of medical marijuana, but that may not use it themselves. And the idea is that medical marijuana patients can't really march on Ottawa. Many of us are too sick, we're too broke. We can't go to the federal government and demonstrate and demand the rights that are guaranteed to us by our Constitution. And so we're going to do this in a virtual manner. We're going to develop a list of both medical marijuana users and their supporters as a kind of online petition. But then we're also organizing a day of action in which all of the people on that list are going to phone, fax, email the federal government in order to let them know that the current policies of this country in regards to the medical marijuana and that our current program is absolutely unacceptable. It's not helping those who need assistance the most, and it's costing our taxpayers monies and resources that could otherwise be used to support the use of medical marijuana. And just for anyone else who might want to find out more information about a virtual medical marijuana march, our website's going to go live probably sometime next week, and it's going to be found at www.compassionatecanadians.ca, compassionatecanadians.ca. And I do encourage people to take a look at that, because I think that, once again, it creates a model that could be very effective in the U.S. right now in getting the government to take notice of the millions of Americans who need access to this benign substance and who are being denied it by an uncompassionate federal government.
And now for another black perspective on the drug war. Some people believe that the whole movement to legalize medical cannabis is just a tactic being used by people who are really after the right to use marijuana for recreational purposes. So the question arises, do people have the right to use substances for recreation? Now, I do not endorse the recreational use of any drug, but I do believe that we each have the right to choose to if we wish. Of all the mood-altering substances people use for recreation, the number one spot must go to sugar. There's hardly a special day, event, or occasion that does not have a specific confection associated with it. From birthday cake to chocolate Easter bunnies, we depend on that sugar rush to put the sparkle into our celebrations. Brain a little fuzzy? Well, no one would deny a person their right to have their morning coffee. A cup of coffee will put enough caffeine in you to make you feel sharp and alert, and that's why the boss gives it to you for free. Chocolate is reputed to have aphrodisiac qualities, which make it the perfect Valentine's Day offering. It's the food that puts her in the mood. However, while candy is dandy, liquor is quicker. And aren't we quick to whip out the bottle when it's time for recreation? Beer at the ball game, champagne on anniversaries, bottle of scotch at Christmas. And just like alcohol consumption, all tobacco use is recreational. And we seem to have a right to smoke if we choose. even though tobacco kills more than 30% of those who use it as directed. Clearly, we have and freely exercise the right to use substances recreationally, from dairy fat to Viagra. Most people enjoy their recreations responsibly, and there's no reason to believe that the recreational use of legal cannabis would be any different. What is irresponsible and dangerous is prohibition, which endangers your health, your safety, your wallet, and your constitutional rights. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Phil Jackson.
And now for our second report coming out of Canada with Mr. Norm Stamper.
I'm Norm Stamper. I was a police officer for 34 years, 28 in San Diego, where as the number two guy, I was recruited to become Seattle's police chief, and I did, in fact, serve as chief of police in the city of Seattle from 1994 to 2000. And I am the author of Breaking Rank, a top cop's expose of the dark side of American policing.
As a fellow spokesman for law enforcement against prohibition, you've been very busy traveling North America, talking about the need for reform of our drug laws, for the calling for the end of prohibition. Tell us about your most recent ventures up in Canada.
Well, I've made visits to Calgary, Abbotsford, Vancouver, Victoria, and a return visit just last week to Victoria, first to speak to the command staff of the Victoria Police Department, where I smuggled in a conversation about drug prohibition and our need to end it. And then the next day was privileged to speak to a Voices of Substance drug reform conference, which was attended by over 175 people.
Tell us about those in attendance. Who was at this conference?
I would say there were mostly service providers. People, there were a good number of drug addicts and recovering addicts and drug policy reformers. But I would say the majority of the people were involved in social service agencies, nonprofits, who are there to provide assistance to the drug-using community in Victoria. Voices of Substance is basically a response to VANDU, which is the Vancouver program for drug users, and SOLID, which is an organization in Victoria. And they're trying basically to build bridges and unite the various agencies in support of drug policy reform.
Well, Norm, as I understand it, even the police agencies up there were, if not participants, were in favor of some of the recommendations being put forward.
Well, I think it's safe to say that the police in Victoria particularly are solidly in support of harm reduction approaches. I have given my anti-prohibition in the drug war talk any number of times, as I said, throughout Canada, and I'm finding a surprising number of people at various levels of law enforcement saying, well, you know, it makes sense. We've got some political obstacles and you know, in some cases in their own minds, they're not really ready to commit to ending the drug war and replacing it with a regulation and control and a medical as opposed to a criminal model. But I think it's safe to say that there is growing support and lots of conversation in Canada among law enforcement.
Now, as I understand it, the current mayor of Vancouver, I think he's the third one in a row, calling for a new attitude.
He's a supporter. This is Sam Sullivan, and you are right. Before him were Campbell and Philip Owens, and I think it's safe to say that Vancouver now has had three mayors who have been very progressive on drug issues. There is a safe in, or supervised, as they now call it, injection site in the downtown east side area of Vancouver. There's strong support for harm reduction approaches. And as I said, in Canada, there's a considerable amount of free dialogue about basically based on the premise that the drug war has not worked, that it's caused more harm than good, and that we need a different model.
You know, recently, Karen Tandy, she's the administrator of the Drug Enforcement Administration, gave an interview to the Houston Chronicle, and she stated that when she took office, when she became administrator, her first priority was money. She seemed gleeful in stating that the DEA has garnered $1.9 billion in forfeiture last year. She said it's the only government agency that just about pays for itself. Your thoughts on that, sir?
Well, I think it's morally reprehensible. It is legal, assuming that the practices of local or federal law enforcement are consistent with legal principles, but the entire strategy is fundamentally bankrupt. If there were no drug war, if we, as a result of our sanctioning all drugs, basically, we have inflated the costs of those drugs, then we've made drug trafficking a very lucrative business, but a dangerous one, and dangerous not only to traffickers and rival drug dealers, but to citizens, to police officers in general. And the proceeds that they get from these seized assets then become a fairly predictable revenue stream for local law enforcement, which then produces, in turn, a dependency on that revenue stream. So there's something just fundamentally wrong with our whole approach to America's drug issues and to drug problems in local communities.
Well, Norm, in your travels, you've, as you say, toured numerous cities in Canada. This U.S., and I think it is U.S.-mandated drug war, stretches its tentacles out into Canada, even into Great Britain and other countries. I understand in Great Britain now they want to recriminalize, to make a felony possession of more than 5 grams, maybe 5 or 10 joints, thus turning potentially every user, sending every user to prison for up to 14 years. Your thoughts on the U.S. mandate that stretches across this globe?
Well, we see ourselves, and I of course refer to the current as well as previous national administrations, DEA, Department of Justice, the Attorney General, all seen collectively as the general in the war on drugs. And we have, in fact, as you so well point out, extended our tentacles into Canada, Great Britain, the Middle East, Latin America. There is no question but what Vicente Fox would have signed legislation that it would have dramatically liberalized and made more sane Mexico's drug laws were it not for American intervention. So all we need to do is, in some cases, is raise an eyebrow or offer a scolding or, you know, threaten to withdraw funds or not provide one form or another of support to some national entity anywhere around the globe, and they cave. You know, we just had the governor in Alaska sign legislation, I believe that was just this last week, that would, in effect, recriminalize marijuana possession. And I personally think, Dean, that that is a result of the anti-drug war proponents putting on more and more heat. We have more and more members of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. We have more and more drug policy reformers in virtually every line of work, many of them within the criminal justice system. And I think the drug warriors are frightened, and they're showing it in their behavior.
Law Enforcement Against Prohibition has many spokesmen on board now, not just cops, but who else are speakers for that organization?
Oh my, we do have police officers, past and present. We have prison wardens, prosecutors. We have probation and parole officers. We have judges. There are many, many attorneys who have signed on as well. Anyone who is a member of the criminal justice system is eligible for membership in LEAP. Those who support our fundamental goal of ending prohibition may join Friends of LEAP, and I would encourage your listeners, Dean, to sign on. We want to build this organization as quickly and as broadly as we possibly can. If people are interested in doing that, the website is www.leap.cc. That's leap.cc. And there is a link for those who are interested in joining. Police officers, others in the justice system who for whatever reasons are reluctant to have their identities become public may join anonymously, and we certainly do encourage that as well.
Well, Norm, as I understand it, you live on some beautiful island up there near Seattle.
I'm about 80 miles away from Seattle, and I do, in fact, live on an island. And, yes, it is beautiful, and it's a perfect place to write, which is sort of my principal passion these days, drug policy reform and writing.
And once again, tell folks the name of your book.
I appreciate that, Dean. It is called Breaking Rank, A Top Cop's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing. It was published last year in hardcover just this past week. It's come out now in paperback. If you have an interest in it, and I hope you do, you can check my website, which is normstamper.com. And I've got excerpts and critical praise for the book and speaking engagements and so forth, all described on that website, normstamper.com.
You know, Norm, I feel certain that drug reform has the moral high ground, has the science, and has the impetus to make the changes. What would you recommend to those who are out there on the fence, who are perhaps leery of speaking up of the need for change? It's all right, isn't it?
It's not only all right. I think it's a moral obligation. We do have, those of us engaged in drug policy reform, do have the high ground. Our work is evidence-based. It's research-driven. Specious reasoning, if not out-and-out lies, are being told by the other side. It's easy for, you know, if you're in one camp to say that about the other camp, but I would urge fence sitters to do their own research and come to their own conclusions. I think if they do that, they'll clearly be aligning themselves with reformers, and as with the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, there is much to be said for taking a stand now, for planting one's stake clearly on the side of, we can quote from the Drug Policy Alliance, reason, justice, and compassion. And I think people who will simply study the evidence will conclude that it is long since past time to end prohibition, to end the war on drugs, which has clearly caused more harm than good.
You know, life is way too short for all this bullshit about drugs and drug abuse and the need to lock up all the little Johnnies and little Janies to protect them from themselves. There is no truth, justice, logic, scientific fact, or medical data to support this drug war. Absolutely none. Please do your part to end this madness of drug war. Prohibido istak Ivalesco.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Duffy.